Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for October 28th, 2009. I'm your host, Command Line, the self-proclaimed hacker, curmudgeon, and hacktivist, and this is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing from over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of society and politics with technology, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and in it, I have a new inner chapter on the subject of perfection and compromise, and a new hacker word of the week. First, though, I wanted to take a moment to help a couple of friends of mine in promoting new books that they've put out this week. The first is Seventh Son Descent by my friend J.C. Hutchins. That launched yesterday. You may have seen his marketing push on Twitter and on his website. This is part of the trilogy that he put out several years ago as a podcast originally, so you may already be familiar with the work. If you're not, this is a thrill ride of a story. It's a heck of a fun read. It's fast-paced and very engaging. It even manages to pull in, I think, some very fascinating elements that are similar to some of the other books that I review and recommend. It explores identity through the use of cloning and memory implant technology, both of which figure very centrally into the story. It even has a hackers, one of the protagonists, Kilroy 2.0. If you did hear that original podcast version, the print edition has new chapters, scenes, and settings. And what makes this even more incredible is that while JC has gotten this book published through St. Martin's through his use of social media, building an audience of over 10,000 listeners, he hasn't forgotten about that original audience that has gotten him there. Actually, the audience is also responsible for another book that I've talked about and helped him promote, Personal Effects Dark Art, his collaboration with Jordan Weissman. Even though he's gotten the chance to go that traditional route to bridge into the traditional publishing world, he has not forgotten about that original audience that got him there. As I said, he is podcasting the new edition both through his own site, and I recommend that version. I've been listening to it, and he adds some commentary, some insights, sort of a director's commentary about the changes, the new material and changes in the edited print edition. But he's also podcasting it through podiobooks.com if you prefer that style, the more straight-up serialization. He's serializing a PDF version of this through Boing Boing and other sites. All of the details for all of the things that he's done with this. There's a whole plethora of other original material. There are giveaways and contests that he's running are available at his website, jchutchins.net. For us, for my listeners, again, because JC is a good friend of mine, he's offered to give away 3 autographed copies of the print edition of Seventh Son Descent. All you have to do is send him an email at seventhsonnovel@gmail.com. I'll include the correct spelling of Seventh Son Novel in the show notes so you're sure to get your entry through. Just put the subject line, Command Line sent me, spell Command Line any way you like, he'll know that you're one of my listeners and I sent you. And in the body of the email, include the words, Kilroy 2.0 is everywhere. And be sure to include your mailing address so that if you're one of the lucky 3 chosen, he knows where to send the signed copy to. He'll run this giveaway until November 6th, so don't hesitate and get those emails into JC. The other book that I wanted to talk about and promote is another person whose work that I believe in very strongly and is a good friend of the show, Cory Doctorow, launched his latest novel, Makers, today. And I'm not going to talk too much about that. I'll include a link to the page on his site with all of the details about the book, including the download edition, the Creative Commons download edition, and he's doing the library exchange program that he's done for the past 2 books as well for this one. The details, as I said, are up at his site for that. And I'm working with him to try to arrange to schedule an interview during his U.S. book tour that he's tentatively planning for the coming month. I think we may be able to catch up at PhilCon the weekend of November 21st up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, but right near Philadelphia, just a couple of hours away from here in D.C. So hopefully, in the next couple of weeks, I'll have an interview with him. sharing more details about his latest novel, about his forthcoming works, including the really fascinating self-published anthology With a Little Help, and hopefully maybe some more details about For the Win, which I believe will be his next novel to be published. The coolest thing about both of these books is you don't have to just take my word, my recommendation for it. There are many ways in both cases where you can try them out before you buy, and I'm convinced that if you do, that you will actually agree with me that these are worth putting on your bookshelf as well.
Gilroy 2.0 is here. Gilroy 2.0 is everywhere. Gilroy 2.0 will be everywhere. And John, and Dr. Mike, and Father Thomas, and the psychopathic John Alpha, as the most popular podcast novel series in history, gets a reboot. Seventh Son Descent is in print now. The beta clones are back with new scenes, new set pieces for the print novel. The President of the United States is dead, murdered by a four-year-old boy, and it's up to John and the other beta clones to hunt the man behind the assassination, John Alpha. To celebrate Seventh Son Descent's bookstore debut, author J.C. Hutchins, that's me, is releasing more clone-killing content at his website and beyond. An entirely new serialized podcast recording of Seventh Son Descent's print edition manuscript, serialized PDFs of the book, free music by John Smith, Seventh Son, 7 Days, a prequel anthology, and the full text of the novel, serialized at boingboing.net, all available now. Support the print debut of Seventh Son Descent. Learn more and download the free audiobook and other content at jchutchins.net and at podiobooks.com.
The Hacker Word of the Week comes from The Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Epsilon squared. Noun. A quantity even smaller than epsilon. As small in comparison to epsilon as epsilon is to something normal. Completely negligible. If you buy a supercomputer for $1 million, the cost of the $1,000 terminal to go with it is epsilon, and the cost of the $10 cable to connect them is epsilon squared. Compare lost in the underflow, lost in the noise. The inner chapters journal my own quest to improve in the craft of programming. Each chapter reflects on a specific practice or principle through the lens of my own experiences, both as a professional and an enthusiast. The name refers to the Chinese classic of philosophy, the Chuanzi. Divided into two sections, the inner chapters make up the first part, attributed to the philosopher Chuanzi himself. The commentaries on the first section, written by his students and others, are known as the outer chapters. I hope you will contribute to my outer chapters by sharing your own thoughts and experiences on growing as a programmer. It was Voltaire who's attributed as saying, "The perfect is the enemy of the good." He may have been describing a sort of asymptote, that is a line or a trend that approaches an arbitrary curve but never actually meets it within a finite distance. Approaching perfection requires infinitely more effort than trying to do just the good, good enough. His words are also advice about self-knowledge. Work towards the good, even towards the perfection, but not at the expense of what is acceptable, what is sufficient. Know when the extra effort has become disproportionate and hence not worth it. It's not that the good is a form of settling, of accepting less, rather understanding what's good enough and what's not worth that extra effort and cost, it's actually very often, especially when we're talking about software development, becomes, like I said, sort of this infinite cost. You can never quite get to perfection. So by definition, every step you take doesn't take you any closer. And it forms a sort of a trap that we need to be aware of as a consequence. I have expressed a certain skepticism of formalisms in the past, in my repeated rants about software frameworks, components, and consultants, and most recently as part of my rant on my love-hate relationship with computer science and the theoretics bound up in the academic pursuit of that field. I think that these actually encourage the pursuit of perfection to the point of detriment that I described earlier. They are very often useful tools, don't get me wrong. They can focus thought, as I've talked about, and aid communication. There is a risk, though. Again, when we're talking about pitfalls and traps, they often encourage thinking there is a perfect form of software, and I don't believe there is any such thing. Or even if there were, that the effort in achieving that would be practical, let alone worthwhile. For one thing, software is very fluid and can be realized any number of ways. Even for the smallest solution, there are often equivalent realizations in source. While it may be possible to render a relative judgment, saying that one approach in code is better than another, even that is going to depend on circumstances, such as the size of inputs, the type of usage, customer requirements and priorities, and so on and so on. Such a relative measurement is rarely made entirely in a vacuum. There is a space of assumptions in which these judgments are actually embedded, whether you realize it or not. To be honest with ourselves, we need to expose these suppositions. Doing so lets us realize that if we alter the shape of these presumptions, then the relative judgment could easily be reversed, that something else could be judged to be superior. If this is all true, then how can we make an absolute evaluation to deem something to be perfect? You may be able to suggest an optimal solution for a given space, but change one variable and that just isn't going to hold true anymore. Optimal also isn't necessarily the same as perfect. Usually it is also an asymptote, approaching some maximum along one or more than one dimension, but never fully reaching it. There's actually a rich study of optimization, mathematical and algorithmic and otherwise. It concedes that the practical outcome is usually shy of some sort of absolute and focuses in on sorts of thresholds or fitness functions for acceptance rather than trying to find that maximal solution. For another consideration, it is very difficult to prove correctness in software. This is another very rich academic area of study. There are some examples of provably correct software, don't get me wrong, that is to say, perfect software by some measure that works exactly as intended and designed. But these examples usually are often constrained in some way. The domain they address is maybe narrow or often very particularly and well-defined. They are usually limited in size, thus limited in their possible complexity. We're usually not talking about systems that evince any qualities of emergence, of unintended behaviors due to more than critical amount of sophistication in how all of the pieces parts fit together. Generally speaking, believing there is one perfect form for any given software can obscure acceptable solutions. Imagine pursuing perfect formal code along the lines of correctness that I've just talked about, only to realize that it has some sort of fatal flaw. 99% perfect and 1% wrong is as bad as if it were all wrong. In fact, by a formal definition of correctness of that program, 1% wrong is still not correct. I tend to think that good enough code encourages thinking more about heuristics, indicators that software actually has reached a level of satisfaction, that we have fitness or acceptance functions that act as thresholds rather than final states. You may also be able to think of them in terms of gauges rather than a threshold that's evaluated once, that it's evaluated in series over time, and then you're actually, what you're measuring is not any single output of that function, but rather you're charting them out into some sort of curve and seeing if you have an acceptable slope to the outputs. That would be to say that, especially when we talk about iterative development, and we talk about small, rapid releases, that over time, a system is getting faster, that it's capable of handling more load, that it's becoming provably more reliable, more stable, more error-free, that that's another way of thinking heuristically about the quality of the software and what it means for that to be sufficient. If you concede your software will never be perfect, you can develop a healthier attitude towards handling inevitable errors as well. That means failing gracefully rather than going to such extreme efforts to avoid all errors. I think that we know of with Intuitive, we all know after a certain point in our development as hackers or professional programmers that errors are inevitable for non-trivial programs, programs above a certain size. So this kind of thinking not about perfection, but thinking about robustness and error resistance makes error handling less painful to the end users, capturing the most useful information for reporting, debugging, and fixing back to you, making the cost of retrying or the user adapting to that error condition as low as you know how to make it, to make it as painless as you know how to make it. I also tend to think that software is best supported as if it were a living thing. My thoughts on looking at heuristics in terms of measuring a slope on some sort of a health function, an acceptance function over time, speaks to that. That designing and building software is ultimately an exercise in acquiring knowledge. As you build it, you learn better what it is that the user actually requires the system to do. You figure out how the software can function, and how ultimately it cannot, what things are not suitable or just not workable. Users participate directly in that exploration through their feedback, bug reports, usability testing, any kind of interaction you have with them in the field or in a more controlled environment. They may also realize new requirements through ones that you do fulfill may open up the opportunities to see other things that software can be evolved to do. That's very natural to the progression of releases that's common with software, with viable, lively software that people find interesting and useful. They may also come to better understand the requirements they had through the use of the software and refine their feedback to you as a consequence and help guide, provide the critical feedback loop that Kent Beck and some of the founders of Extreme Programming talk about in having customers directly involved, much more closely involved than in other more rigid forms of process management. I don't think this process ever stops either, except maybe for the smallest, simplest definitions of problems and solutions. Maybe something that's not a complete standalone system on its own, but slots into a larger system or is a very simple throwaway program of some sort. If you want to keep working on software, the fact that it is a living thing is a good thing. That sort of engagement keeps your skills evolving over time. It certainly keeps the need fresh and consistent over time for you to exercise those skills to continue to meet these evolving needs of your customers. It ultimately, though, precludes any sort of final finished state of software, let alone any notions of perfection, unless it is a software that's no longer used, that is or has become irrelevant. Again, we can look at this both as a challenge, like I said, to keep you engaged in developing your skill, both in relating to the customer and understanding the problem space and developing your solution, but also as an opportunity. The fact that because if your software is successful, that it's going to go through multiple releases, that it's going to have continuing and evolving demands on it, means there's always opportunity to improve it later. Again, speaking to that continuous improvement aspect that I've been hinting at as well. Another thought that occurs to me in contemplating this is that if you are so fixated on perfection that you're really looking at that finished goal state and you're not thinking about that continuous progress of software, that continuous iteration, you may be closing yourself off to the process itself too. That, you know, nobody learns anything by releasing software. They learn by developing, continuously developing software. They improve by taking on new challenges, release after release after release. So that's something to take into consideration as well, as what are you closing yourself off to in terms of opportunities by fixating on perfection rather than taking the software as it is, taking the process as it is, and dealing with problems in the small, actually realizing those opportunities to improve along the way and have what can ultimately be very fulfilling and enjoyable experiences along the way as well. Experiences of learning, experiences of achievement and accomplishment that might really be diminished by standing them up in the shadow of this unrealistic notion of perfection. So how do you recognize when you're erring on the side of perfection? Level of effort is often a good telltale. If each change takes disproportionately, increasingly more effort than the last change, odds are you are past the knee in the curve. You've met some definition of sufficient for the software, and you're on that steep, steep climb towards perfection. Use the feedback from the users. Work hard to hear what they are actually saying versus what you think they're saying, or trying to interpret it too closely against, again, these unrealistic ideas of some perfect solution that you have in mind. You really need to struggle to set aside your own perceptions, presuppositions, and biases about the requirements and the solution, and just focus on that receptive communication. This is actually where, again, as I've implied, a dedicated usability expert may be able to help. Someone who can synthesize the direct feedback from the user, understand it in a different realm, more suitable to the direct interaction between the user and the software that you're devising, and then work with you more in the engineering realm to figure out what that means in terms of design and implementation. The fact that someone who is working on exclusively the usability aspects of the project doesn't have any real expertise, background, or expectations around engineering frees them up to be much more receptive than you might be with your own kind of hang-ups coming in to talk to a customer. Again, their training, their background, their experience is about that user interaction. It's not about systems and programming. So there can be a very fruitful collaboration in my experience if you have a more of a multidisciplinary approach like that, if you're in a position where you have such a person available to you, such expertise available to you. Quality assurance in the absence of usability can also serve this function if they're, again, adequately independent from the actual coding side of the development effort. Customer support, if we have to get creative, can also serve in this role, acting as very direct customer proxies. And again, that much more removed from the actual engineering efforts that go into the software. So again, in an ideal world, you would have someone working in a domain that's specific to that user interaction, but you can get creative. And I've certainly worked on projects and within organizations where they haven't had such a person available, and they've filled in as needs be, recognizing that people who work on more customer-facing issues may have similar experiences that have the same kind of bearing, even though, again, they don't have the same directed expertise somebody who's an interaction designer might. And the fact that, again, their day-to-day reality is dealing with customer-reported issues, communicating with customers respectively, that they can bring that necessary detachment into the project development by being a very different kind of stakeholder. Now that we have some sense of what the problem is and some suggestions on how to recognize it, how do you actually go about correcting this urge towards perfection? Well, first, I think you can try to triage suggestions and ideas that might skew development towards these unrealistic goals and learn how to punt on the ones that are more costly to implement. Again, remember cost being or level of effort being a pretty good indicator that you're on an unrealistic slope. Which ideas are difficult enough on their own without a perfect solution that may weight towards the steeper end of the list that you develop? Which ones are polishing up the system for the sake of perfection that are wasted motion? It may not be expensive, but it's not something that is going to rise above the level of notice for the people who are actually using the system. Use your customers again and your customer proxies, which I just talked about, to aggressively gauge acceptance. Be brutally honest with yourself. Be brutally honest in your receipt of their criticism and their input. This does require holding them to task. they will clearly always want more. Again, speaking about that living system, if it's valuable today and you've satisfied some deep itch, that's really, unfortunately, going to prompt more need. And that's good. That's a sort of virtuous circle, a constructive circle that you want to encourage. But you need to, in that exercise of prioritization, you need to be able to manage that to the time that you have for any particular iteration. You need to frame questions very clearly as to whether a solution meets the requirements, not allow the conversation to stray too far afield. Be open to hearing a new requirement or some chance topic or tangent that comes up in the discussion, but just capture those and manage those changes much in the same way that you manage code changes. There are requirement change systems out there, but you can use very simple tools for capturing these and setting them aside, coming back to them later to enhance and reprioritize them, add your comments. Time is always limited, even on open source projects. If a project is successful, though, as I've said, you will get another release, another version, another chance to address any further requirements or ideas that come up. Learn to trust to that and push out ideas, tasks that actually can wait, and do them later rather than trying to do everything all at once. That's also another form of, perfection, is that trying to accomplish everything overnight, instantly. There's a saying, you can't boil the ocean. There's not enough energy that you could put in fast enough to make that happen. So you have to back off from that and realize what's can actually be meaningfully and feasibly done. There's incidental value, too, to capturing those extra things that come out of these sort of honest communications. These improvements in your understanding of the problem may save you from even having to code those further out ideas. It's cheaper to spend time in the discussion, in that discovery, before you even code, before you even deliver. That's a useful heuristic as well to keep in mind, is to waste more time on the things that ultimately don't have a certain fixed risk to them. A conversation is one of the least risky activities that we can get involved in developing a project. I've mentored several team members through this urge to perfection. As a leader or a manager, it's a little bit easier. You can use the pressure of a deadline to limit the opportunity to polish too much. Ideally, you have to get the person to realize what it is that they are doing. You have to encourage and lead them to a state of enough self-awareness that they understand some of the things I've been talking about how to recognize that you're struggling for perfection past the point of it being useful. If you can get them to understand why sacrificing the good is a risk in pursuit of the best, then you're well on your way. They don't also immediately have to correct their behavior, just better understanding that trade-off. Once you kind of get them there, it's much easier to start using a lighter and lighter touch. You want to get them to a point where they're simply reminding them of the current priorities, you know, kind of guiding them to scaling back their own efforts. Is sufficient, that they're aware of this on their own and they can start to self-correct. Allow them to hang ideas and tasks on future releases, again, as I've discussed. You know, build up that trust that they'll get another chance, that nobody is cutting them off and preventing them from doing further development. That, again, if the project is viable, lively, valuable, and interesting, everybody's going to get a chance to keep working on it, to keep approaching those interesting challenges and ideas and continuing to play with that code. Often, that's enough. Acknowledging what they'd ideally like to do and just committing to exploring it later as time allows. Very often, that's enough to back off on some of the pressure. And both teammates that I've helped with this ultimately got the point. I think that they became much better developers once they got to a point where they were able to self-correct their own behavior. And I think they were also a lot less stressed out as a consequence. They realized that they were the only ones holding them up to this impossible measure, that everybody else had much more realistic expectations. And when they had that faith that they would be able to continue developing on things in successive releases, that also alleviated pressure, as I've said. I got both of them to a point where they required little more than a ready ear to listen when they kind of got stuck in a frustrated loop. They usually figured out on their own where they're focusing too much, just in actually taking the time to try to explain where they're at and their plan of attack moving forward. And so that's a pretty good example, I think, of a successful outcome, so that you'll be able to recognize that your own self, if you're in a position to be able to help somebody very directly. Again, not necessarily as a leader or manager as I was, but maybe as a teammate, as a peer mentor as well. These are just some of my experiences and thoughts on this notion of this challenge and this opportunity of perfection versus compromise. And as always, if you have your own anecdotes, your own tips for recognizing and dealing with this, unfortunately, rather common problem among developers, I'd very much appreciate hearing it and being able to share it with everybody else. Theme music is The Wicked Thoughts of You by Tafubar, remixed by Mo Shang for the album Asian Variations. For more information, visit asianvariations.com. This music used under permissions of a Creative Commons music sharing license. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, go to the website at thecommandline.net, make a donation, purchase some swag, or at the very least, tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night as usual, will be a news program. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Libsyn and Waha to Be for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permissions to use those are granted under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike Version 3.0 United States License.